Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca. If you watch the evening news on television, you're familiar with the bombardment of commercials for prescription drugs. Pills for this, pills for that. Some pills with side effects that seem far worse than the malady they claim to cure. At every commercial break, you are urged to ask your doctor if this pill is right for you. If you've had an appointment with your doctor during the past year or so, you've probably noticed the handheld device he or she was holding, and you may even have wondered if they were paying complete attention to you. Today, we'll ask two local physicians about the effect of all those drug commercials, about going digital in the doctor's office, and about other changes and developments in medical practice. With us today are Dr. Catherine Merrill and Dr. Thomas Duncan, both with offices in Astoria. So, Kate and Tom, welcome. Glad you're with us.
Hi, how are you?
I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about those drug commercials or about how you perceive them on your end. Do patients come in your office and ask about the little purple pill or whatever else the drug commercials are telling them to do?
It happens once in a while. Actually, it happens far less than I'd expect it to. I think when commercials were newer, I heard it more often, but now that they've been out there a lot, people don't ask quite as often for a specific medication. But when they do, I think right away my first inclination is to not give them just that exact medication, just because of the advertisement itself. But I do obviously then explore the reason why they think they might need it and to figure out what their problem is and go back to what the basis of medicine is when you're treating somebody in the office, diagnosing their problem and helping them to figure out what to do about it rather than push a specific pharmaceutical company's medication.
People come in all the time and they say, I've got arthritis and is this pill ready for me? And I say, well, this pill is, or this injection in many cases, is useful for rheumatoid arthritis, but it can kill you and you don't have rheumatoid arthritis. and so I sort of leave it up to them. And they also have pills for pain. I mean, the big thing now is chronic pain. And they want to know if, I won't mention any drugs, but a specific drug is right for their chronic pain. And I say, well, it's very similar to other drugs that are on the market right now. It's very expensive, and I'd be happy to prescribe it for you. But don't ask me for a prior authorization because I won't do it. I'm not in the business of marketing drugs.
Yeah, so that whole prior authorization issue is most insurance companies have a list of medications that they prefer patients to get because they're less expensive for the patient and for the insurance company. And if you try to use some second or third generation, and that being more expensive medication, they make you fill out a lot of paperwork proving why you can't use the cheaper one. And sometimes it's valid reasons and it goes through and the patient can get what they need. Sometimes it's not reasonable that they need it, but they just want it. And whichever case, there's a lot of paperwork that has to be filled out, and that adds to the administrative burden on our end, and I'm sure on the insurance company's end as well.
I guess one of the things that occurs to me when I watch the commercials is, if you're going to your doctor, wouldn't he or she already know if you needed this drug? Do the commercials actually add anything?
No, they don't, but they do jog the doctor's memory, you know. I've been in the business quite a while, and I suppose I could be over the hill, but I try to keep up. And I do know about these new drugs, but I also know that old drugs work just as well in most cases. So I usually don't even bring them up. So people do jog my memory. They do bring in a lot of things. They inevitably, in this digital age, they search the internet. You know, and they can find out if I say that they have a specific disease, they're going to look it up on the internet and bring me in huge pages and pages and pages of stuff. So I have to be ready to address that in some meaningful way. Mm-hmm. And one of those, of course, is the drugs. And I frequently, because I do have these handheld devices now, and I I look these things up on the internet in the exam room and talk about these drugs, what they could offer that the current medicines they're particularly on right now or the other options that they've chosen, you know, what does this new thing promise? Mm-hmm. And we sort of discussed that. So it is a good entree or segue to talking about how better to do the job of taking care of their particular chronic problem.
But let's face it, advertisements on TV are designed to get people to buy things or get you to prescribe things for them to buy, and they're not medical advice. And I think coming from a generation where medical information on television was either a public service announcement or some sort of news program, people that have lived through that transition are often, I think, bamboozled by the idea that these advertisements aren't just giving advice.
I totally agree with that. And the thing is that this has become a sort of cat and mouse game between the insurance companies on the one hand and the drug companies on the other hand, and the government on the third hand. And we have the United States Preventive Health Task Force coming out with recommendations and guidelines, which, although they're not force of law, they have pretty substantial impact on the way we practice medicine. That's from the government. And then we have the insurance companies that are trying to maximize their profits, which means they don't want to spend money on these new drugs. And then we have the drug companies that are obviously trying to sell new drugs. I mean, that's why they're in business. And so there's the real problem to me is that it switched really from a patient-centered view of things to a drug-centered view of things. Mm-hmm. Lots of things are not even drug treatable. I mean, you take osteoarthritis, which practically everybody has, me included, and you're hurting all the time. What are you going to do? Well, you don't have a lot of options. And so you have to think about what the real options are, and many of them are not drugs. Mm-hmm. But when you go to conferences anymore, a lot of times they are sponsored by drug companies. And so the conference really comes down to how do you diagnose a condition that will be able to be prescribed this particular drug, not how are you going to take care of a particular condition. Mm-hmm. So medicine in some ways has become how to be more efficient at prescribing drugs rather than how to take care of people better. Mm. And the insurance companies, they want to... They're not really in the business of trying to do the best job for patients. They're in the job of rewarding their shareholders. And so one of the things they do is not tell you that you shouldn't be prescribing drugs, but that you shouldn't prescribe those drugs that are too expensive for them.
Too expensive for the insurance company.
For the insurance company. Yeah. So that's kind of where the focus has gone away from patient-centered, reasonable treatments, given the technology that's available, to arguments about what drug is going to work better, not what procedure or what lifestyle modification or something else that's non-drug. It's all drug-focused anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you really have to kind of step back, not just from the patient's point of view that maybe there's a drug to fix something, because they don't always all follow that route. But, you know, from our own biases and the advertising that even in our professional societies we're subjected to, that's definitely a mindset to remember to pull back from. Mm-hmm. Not see a patient with a specific diagnosis and the first thing come to your mind, well, what medication is that? Are you going to use to treat that? And I think as primary care doctors, since we see people with all kinds of social, medical, psychological problems, I think we're probably a little bit better at pulling back and thinking about things more holistically than maybe a specialist would be. And a lot of the stuff that you see advertised on television is specialty medications.
In any new drug that's coming on the market nowadays is pretty much just exactly like the old ones, except more expensive. There really have not been any new drugs since, I can't remember when. I mean,
the immunotherapy.
Immunotherapy, the biologics are new, but in terms of blood pressure, diabetes, all these kinds of things.
They just want a slice of that pie. It's all me too drugs.
Right, but we don't prescribe those in our office. Mm-hmm. We just kind of stick with the old ones because they don't work. They work just as well as the new ones.
Well, what about that little handheld device that
that we see now when we go into our doctor's office. What brought that about? What's its purpose, and how is it used, and how is that going?
Well, there's not just one handheld device, and I don't know, but that's probably a whole other show, but everybody's pretty much plunging in with what makes sense for them. But basically, I think what you're pointing to is the fact that many practices have started to use an electronic medical record instead of the old paper record. Mm-hmm. Lots of reasons why. There's some government mandates. Mostly they come through initially Medicare, but then the commercial insurances usually follow whatever Medicare sets up as regulations. And Medicare has, in the last several years, decided that if you're not adopting an electronic medical record and using it in a meaningful way that they define as meaningful, that they'll start reducing reimbursement rates. And so many, I think the last statistics I heard were over 50% of doctors' offices were now using an electronic medical record to prevent basically cuts in the already, I think, arguably fairly low reimbursements that Medicare gives us.
Mm-hmm. It's a series of carrots and sticks. They gave us a bunch of money to adopt the record, and then they told us if we didn't use it, we would be penalized for failure to use this thing meaningfully. When the government set up electronic medical records, they didn't really set up any standards.
An electronic medical record. They just said
electronic medical records.
Make one,
you know.
And lots of companies did.
There are hundreds of companies out there making electronic medical records. The idea was that it was going to be more efficient. We wouldn't be ordering duplicate tests if we sent somebody to a specialist or if they went to the hospital. Everybody could kind of intercommunicate, and so we would reduce duplication, reduce errors. We wouldn't be making the same kinds of mistakes that we make when we write prescriptions, because the medical record would check the prescription and make sure that it was a reasonable prescription. A lot of kind of pipe dreams. The problem has turned out that there isn't any interoperability. That's a term that they use. One medical record can't talk to another medical record.
Oh. So you're not getting any of those benefits.
You get none of those benefits. And the reason they can't talk to each other is because every single medical record producer has a different file system. And so there's no way that you can directly
link
one company's file to another company's file, because the file formats are different and they don't fit together.
So a patient may have some of his information in one proprietary file and some of his information in some other proprietary file because he's gone to different doctors.
Right, that's correct.
And so you would have no way of knowing whether he was prescribed a certain thing here or
well,
whether he was treated.
The funny thing about it is we do. And the way we do it is the same way we did when we were on paper records, is they send this stuff to us, and then I put it in as data into my machine. It's not integrated data that I can manipulate and move around, but it's a sheet of paper, essentially, that has all the information and then some that I used to always routinely get. So that part of the system is the same, and there are ways around the old-fashioned just faxing forms back and forth to each other. And there's a dream, I think, of being able to have like a clearinghouse where that stuff goes and it can be more easily found. But that'll probably happen after I retire.
If you're trying to communicate with somebody else's program, you can't send a database file to them and have them integrate it into their record. All you can send is basically a fax. They print it out in a paper format, although it's not a paper format. It's PDF.
Right.
It comes down as an image file, not a text file. It's 100 times more bulky.
Right.
It isn't searchable, at least not in any meaningful sense.
Right.
So if somebody comes in from Dr. Jones, they've had a consultation, and you look in your imported items and you see in this list of imported items Dr. Jones's report, you can pick it up and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, Dr. Jones's report would not be in imported items like that. It would actually be filed in your own database,
right,
where you could search it and find it quickly. It doesn't work like that.
And so that gets back to the whole observation about how do these records, these electronic medical records, affect the doctor-patient interaction in the office. And you know, they're designed to be, I guess, electronically efficient, but I don't find them from a workflow standard point of view as being efficient. And they do get in the way. In order to be efficient with my EMR, I need to be typing things into it as I'm making decisions while I'm talking to the patient, and that requires me to not look at the patient. And so I tend to be less efficient in the room with that sort of record keeping and documentation, and it costs me a lot of time outside of the room that I end up doing for an hour to 2 hours more a day than I used to do before I had the EMR.
It's still taking you longer on the other end than it would be if you were using paper.
It's much more time consuming.
Much more time consuming. In the old days, what I used to do when I had a paper chart is what I do now in the room is I actually don't use the computer too much while I'm talking to the patient. I try not to sit and listen to their story and figure out what's going on. And then what I would do previously is go back to my office right after the office visit and pick up my little dictaphone and dictate into a little tape my summary of what we just did. And then it would go to my transcriptionist and she would type it up for me, and then it would end up back in my paper chart. Now what I do is I go back to my room and I click on all the boxes to order this or that test that I'm going to order instead of, I used to fill out a form probably, and now I can just click boxes. But the dictation is done with a voice recognition system, which is remarkably about, I would say, 95% accurate. That extra 5% takes me a lot of time because now I'm the secretary that gets to proofread all of those documents before they're finalized and as my official record, and that takes me a lot of time.
Right. The electronic medical record has basically turned physicians into ward clerks and transcriptionists
and
clerks and secretaries and clerks in general. We are taking up, it's more efficient from the administrator's point of view because we do the job of three or four different people. It's not more efficient in the sense that we're paid more than these people. So we're going absolutely backwards.
Yeah.
For me to be a transcriptionist and edit my own stuff is crazy.
And you're stuck with it.
But I'm stuck with it because that's the only way you can get this in.
The only way you can get paid for what you do is to do it.
Yeah. Well,
and you want a complete medical record so that you can take care of your patients.
You want a legible medical record that makes sense.
Yeah.
Which is why probably the best part of the EMR, and I don't think they're all evil, but they're just mostly evil. I think the best part of it is actually the prescription writing functions. And I think most people would agree that those are actually very useful. And I'm sure the pharmacists definitely enjoy being able to read what we send them since it's now electronic. And it in many ways can be quite efficient and quick compared to handwriting prescriptions, though it has its own dark side as well, I think the goal was that they'd be more accurate and fewer mistakes. But anytime you make a system more complicated, you're more likely to get more mistakes, and there's still things that can go wrong.
I make mistakes all the time because in the prescription writing part of it, you have these drop-down boxes, and if you click the wrong thing on the drop-down box, you can get a tablet instead of a
capsule,
or you can get a liquid instead of or you can get a suppository. I'm forever prescribing suppositories to people. I really mean a tablet, but it's just in the drop-down box, and if you happen to get your
mouse
exactly
just
in
wrong.
The wrong place, it's going to come out with something really bizarre.
Well, anyone who uses a computer can relate to that.
Yeah.
And I think anybody who uses a smartphone or uses a pad of some kind also can relate to the idea that even though we all think we're great multitaskers, we're really not so good at it.
No.
Especially visual. If you're looking at the screen, you cannot listen to somebody.
No.
If I'm writing, in the old days, I would just write handwritten notes, you know, to kind of jog my memory. And then I would dictate it later. Mm-hmm. I can't do that now. I, I, I have to type it in.
Because you could do that without even looking.
Yeah.
Well, I still actually do it not infrequently. I do it my old-fashioned way, and then I go back to my room and do my voice recognition software dictation. But
But I can't do that between patients because the patients just keep coming in so fast, you know?
I tend to run behind a lot more than I ever used to,
I try to stay up. It's impossible.
Try.
People
it's
get
impossible.
Really annoyed if they have to wait.
Yeah.
Sure.
And so if you're trying to dictate in between patients, you're taking up a lot of office time to do a clerical task. And it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, the reason you're there is to see patients, not to be proofreading your voice recognition.
Well, I certainly don't complete my dictations in between patients, but I get the basics down because that's the best time to get the most accurate record in is immediately after I remember it. And then all of that proofreading is why... hour and a half after seeing my last patient today, I was still in the office before I had to come here, and I'll go back and do another hour of work before I go home.
Is there any light at the end of this tunnel? I mean, do you see, you mentioned maybe you retire.
Yes, I'm going to retire someday.
No, not in the current. You see, the problem for me, they're mostly evil, like Kate says. The medical record was not designed to solve any problem the doctors ever had.
Nope.
The medical record was designed for the purpose of IT professionals and administrators. And it does, to some extent, solve their problems in being able to sell products.
And they'd like
and
to being count able beans.
To count beans, to do things to doctors. But it doesn't solve our problems. If the medical record was designed to facilitate communication between physicians and patients, it could be done. But it would take an entire rewrite of all the medical record software that's out there. Mm-hmm. It's mostly for the administrators, and it's mostly for administrators in big organizations.
Yeah, and it's ways for CMS, which is the organization that runs Medicare, and for insurance companies to be able to keep track of what we're doing, and in my jaded opinion, to eventually figure out ways to cut our reimbursements. Well, let's face it, you know, we have a population of aging individuals, this whole baby boom thing that I think I've heard of, and we have fewer people that are going to be paying into the pool of money that's going to be needed to treat everybody as they get older and need treatment. You can't just make it up out of nothing. Mm-hmm. Eventually, something's got to have to give, and they're going to have to cut something, and they're slicing away at the edges, but eventually the reimbursements for everything, they're going to have to go down over time. There's no way to sustain the system otherwise. None of what we've talked about is really anything that a current student of medicine would learn either in medical school or residency. It has very little to nothing to do with the practice of medicine. Mm-hmm. And yet it's something that dominates at least half of what we do every day.
Mm. That's right.
It's administrative. It's how you can stay in business.
Well, nowadays, at least 80% of physicians coming out of training programs are looking for a job with an insurance company, a hospital, or a large clinic. Mm. They're looking to be hired help. Whereas in my generation, and I think Kate's generation, most of the physicians coming out of training programs were expected to go into some kind of a private practice. The issue here is that if you're in a private practice, you're really the focus of your attention is your patient. I mean, your primary goal is to serve the patient. If you're hired by somebody, your primary goal is to serve whoever it is that's hiring you.
Sure.
So there are built-in conflicts of interest in the current setup where doctors are increasingly being hired by these large corporations, many of whom have passive investors. I mean, now what happens is that medicine has been commodified, and the beneficiaries of what's going on with your disease and your doctor is not you and the doctor. It's the investors in the insurance company or the large organization that's hiring you. Mm-hmm. It changes the whole perspective of what's going on in medicine, and it changes the dynamic in rather unfortunate ways for me.
Are there other major ways in which the practice of medicine has changed over time since you started in significant ways? I guess, you know, one thing that occurs to me, I'm old enough to remember that you went to your GP. And pretty much that's the only doctor you ever saw. You were unlikely to be sent off to a specialist somewhere, and that seems like that has changed a great deal now. But in terms of your practices, are things different because of all these the different pressures from different places, or are you still able to basically do what you wanted to do when you went to medical school in terms of dealing with your patients?
I think it's interesting in an era where primary care has not drawn as many medical students into the field. Most these days, I think medical students are deciding to go into a specialty, and the more specialties or people practicing specialty medicine that you have, the more likely people are, surprise, surprise, to get specialty consultations.
I guess my practice has now sort of evolved into talking people down after they've seen the specialist.
I do a lot of that, too.
They're totally confused. They're upset. There are certain things that the specialists do and do very well. Mm-hmm. But because there are so many specialists under our current system, they wind up doing a lot of primary care. But they don't do primary care very well because they don't know these people. Mm-hmm. And so people go into they come into my office and they're coming in because they can't breathe very well. They don't come in because they got heart failure. They come in because they can't breathe very well. And so I have to decide if it's a pulmonary problem or a heart problem or a kidney problem. And I can quickly decide that because I've seen this all my life. Mm-hmm. Or I can say, well, you can't breathe very well. We're going to send you to the nephrologist because you've got kidney failure. Or we're going to send you to the cardiologist because you've got heart failure. Or we're going to send you to the pulmonologist because you've got bad lungs. Mm-hmm. They probably got all three. So in the current system, they go to all these different specialists. They might get conflicting opinions about what to do about it. And they invariably come back and see me or Kate. You know, what am I going to do? And I can't follow all these different rules because they're all conflicting. Mm. And what's more, I like to eat sausage.
Let's talk treatment plan. What are your goals in life? It's a privileged position to be in. I feel very honored to get to know people for a long period of time and help them through, you know, the good times, the bad times. And I think it's really special when you get to come to one place and stay in one place and practice there and know the community and the individuals that see you regularly. And I think that's where you have a real chance to do good, because there's lots of technology. And certainly if somebody gets breast cancer, I'll be the first to make sure they see the right specialist to get that treated. But there's, as Tom's alluding to, there's an awful lot of stuff that happens to a person that there isn't a clear-cut answer what medicine can offer. And you have to be able to know them and work with them and help them help you figure out what's important to them and how you want to manage whatever problems that they have.
It's kind of, in a way, takes us back full circle to the drug advertising in a way, because the doctor that you've been seeing and who knows you knows whether a particular drug actually is going to help the issue that you have.
Before you even get there, probably.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you both, Dr. Merrill, Dr. Duncan. And you've been listening to The Human Beat.